This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 25th of April 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Phil Han.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll bring you the top three stories you'll need to know in our agenda setter. Today, we talk Eurozone crisis, North Korea, and Japan's break from the past.
French President François Hollande has had a tough time since moving into the Elysee Palace. Some are even calling him a 21st century Louis XVI. Is he just not the right man for the job?
There is a feeling that this man is not presidential enough, a too normal man for too exceptional circumstances.
A series of 8 bomb blasts have rocked Pakistan in less than 24 hours. We head to Islamabad for the latest.
And in this week's preview of The Urbanist, we take a look at brain mapping. How does the human brain compare to sat-nav in cities?
Looking at taxi drivers, we could see that they only really use their hippocampus at the beginning of a journey. And that fits their kind of subjective reports that they say, well, it's like the vehicle takes over. As I drive through a city, I don't really think about it. My car does all the work for me.
All that, plus we'll review today's Brazilian front pages and we play some music as well. That's all to come here on the next hour on Midori House.
So a jam-packed show as ever this morning, 1 minute past 8 in the morning in London. First of all, let's get the news headlines from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The number of people killed in the collapse of an 8-storey building in the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka has risen to at least 160. That figure is expected to rise as many more are feared trapped in the ruins. Over 1,000 people were injured when the building collapsed on Wednesday. It contained clothing factories and a shopping centre. The owners have gone into hiding after it emerged that they'd been warned not to allow workers into the building following the discovery of cracks in some of the walls and pillars. The country's prime minister has declared Thursday a national day of mourning. US investigators have told a House of Representatives committee that the bombs used at the Boston Marathon were detonated by the kind of remote device used to control a toy car. The House Intelligence Committee said the bombers found the information on how to build the bomb from Inspire magazine. Inspire was created by the American Yemeni preacher Anwar al-Awlaki, a leader of al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen who was killed in a US drone strike. Officials have also revealed that an FBI-led joint terrorism task force in Boston was alerted when one of the two brothers who later allegedly carried out the bombings travelled to Russia. The official said Russia tipped off the FBI about Tamerlan Tsarnaev in early 2011 and asked the agency to look into him. A second identical request to the CIA was made in late September that year. As a result, a US intelligence official said the CIA nominated Tsarnaev's name for inclusion on a government watch list. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
What we do know is that the FBI took action in response to that notification, investigated the elder brother, and investigated thoroughly and came to the conclusion that there was no derogatory information, no indication of terrorist activity or associations, either foreign or domestic, at that time.
Thousands of law enforcement agents from around the United States have attended a memorial for the university police officer who the authorities say was shot dead by the Boston bombing suspects. The officer, Sean Collier, and the youngest victim of the bombing attack, 8-year-old Martin Richard, were buried in private ceremonies on Tuesday. Vice President Joe Biden attended Wednesday's service at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He had this to say to Sean Collier's parents.
And Mom, Dad, and Joe, my heart goes out to you. I hope you find some solace in this moment of extreme grief and looking around this field and listening to what is being said and written. The response of the people of this country and around the world about your son.
Thousands of people have attended a dawn service held at Anzac Cove in Gallipoli to mark the 98th anniversary of the day Australian and New Zealand troops landed during the First World War. In a campaign lasting 8 months, the Allied forces were evacuated with heavy casualties from both sides of over 120,000. In honour of the Australian and New Zealand soldiers who lost their lives, the Turkish government later named the place Anzac Cove. The publisher of a French celebrity magazine has been placed under formal investigation for breach of privacy over last year's publication of topless pictures of Britain's Duchess of Cambridge. A judicial source says the female photographer who snapped the pictures of Prince William's wife has also been put under investigation, as has the regional daily La Provence, which published photographs of the couple in swimming suits during the same holiday in France. Being put under investigation is the last step in France before being charged, but it does not necessarily lead to formal charges. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Way you London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House live from Studio One in London. 6 minutes past eight in the morning. Time to get ready and set the day's agenda. This is the part of the show where we ask our experts to choose the three big stories they think we'll need to know about over the next 24 hours.
And today we're joined by Alessio Padolano, professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College London and regular Monocle 24 contributor. Alessio, thanks very much for coming on the program this morning.
Good morning.
So you've chosen the three stories that we'll need to know for the next 24 hours. What's the first one that's grabbed your attention?
Well, the first one is on The Guardian. It's on The Guardian's front page today and concerns new data released about how the situation, what's the perception of the European Union among Europeans. And it's not necessarily good news today.
No surprise, though, there.
Well, to a degree, the surprise is the extent to which we've witnessed a transformation in terms of general perception. We know that the situation wasn't going great lately, but
I like your understatement there, Alessio.
Well, you know, I'm Italian, so I must be positive. You know, I'm genetically designed to be positive.
My goodness, if you can have a positive Italian yeah. talking about the Eurozone, that's really something.
Actually, that's true.
But I mean, does this raise fundamental questions about democratic legitimacy? How bad is this? What does it really mean?
Yes, no, absolutely. I think that the key element of that is emerging from this debate. Actually, there's two factors. One is the democratic legitimacy of the EU as the perception, the popular perception is changing, and people are trusting less European institution as a way forward. But there is another level, I think, and is the tension, the natural tension that exists between the economic crisis that has been going around for a few years now and the growth of nationalism. So people are withdrawing, are looking inward, and so the key question, I suppose, that we have to watch out for over the next few months is really the extent to which politicians will be able to provide answers to close the gap that now is being created between this negative perception and this comeback of nationalism and the role of the EU in terms of future growth of the European.
And we have seen in the past couple of months, or the past year or so, the rise of nationalist right-wing parties in places like Greece, even in France or Italy. Is that a real concern that today's more centrist leaders really need to watch out for?
Well, I think that is certainly a symptom of a malaise. You know, people are not really positive, particularly because politicians, the only formula they seem to have found is that austerity, austerity, austerity. We need to watch out, we need to tighten the belts and so on and so forth. I think from Italy, of all places, a very important sign. The first thing that the person has been singled out as the next prime minister, Enrico Letta, was saying is that we need to change this. We need to tackle this problem. We need to start thinking about growth and talk about growth. Talking positive will bring about debate about how we can find the solution out. So this might be a solution.
But talk is cheap, let's face it.
True, absolutely. But I think that perception is very important, especially in the contemporary world where finances dominates debates.
But just keeping in Italy, where you're from, you know, many people were heralding Beppe Grillo and his party as a party of change, a party that would, you know, fundamentally, drastically change are the politics of Italy. But as we saw, he was really able to accomplish nothing. And as Clemenzi said, talk is cheap.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Cheaper than a bailout, certainly.
Well, definitely. I think the problem there is that there are elements of his agenda in terms of reformation addressing serious concerns that are not just about Italy, but they're spreading across Europe. And that is the lack of trust towards the political class in general. I think the problem with Grillo was that so far he hasn't really proposed an alternative agenda. So you want to destroy the current system, you want to change things, what's the alternative you're proposing? And that seems to be the missing part.
What do you think the likely impact will be on austerity measures, on sort of what will the politicians do next as a result of these findings? Which we should point out, it's a massive survey, but it is by Eurobarometer, the EU's yes. polling organisation, but it is only of six countries: Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Spain and Poland, so the biggest countries in the Eurozone. But what are we likely, what's the impact going to be of this, if any?
Well, certainly if this new poll is going to be taken any seriously, there will be a debate about whether European countries should get actually closer together just start rethinking the basics. And I think what it seems to be coming out of the European Union is this idea that they want to try to move towards federalism, which would be a bold move, but at the same time a very interesting one, because it will also bring about another important debate. What is the Europe the European wants in the future? Now, that is one of the crucial problems in terms of when we look at the data, there is a growing sense of mistrust that Europe is more and more Germany trying to take in control over Europe. So these two debates aren't really what one would expect the politicians to take on over the next few months.
Sticking with the theme of growing mistrust, let's talk about China and North Korea.
Absolutely. Now, this is an interesting story. Although, I mean, we've been talking, and you know, that seldom there's a day without some sort of news coming out of China that will influence the agenda in a wider sense. But this, to me, was interesting in a funny way, because it's the latest reports on what General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff in the United States, was reporting about his very fruitful talks in China. Now, on the surface, we know that the situation is very positive. Looking up, you know, China and the United States apparently see eye to eye insofar as putting a lead over North Korea and their nuclear program. But when you start skimming beneath the surface, there's something that is emerging that is quite puzzling. Effectively, the Chinese haven't really said anything to him. And on the more important points, there was an element of going separate pathways among the two of them.
Because the Chinese were never, you know, being completely pragmatic, the Chinese were never going to turn their back on North Korea. But because they want North Korea there, they want North Korea to stay the way it is, don't they?
Absolutely. I think on one level, there is a problem in the sense that the new leadership in China, I mean, for a very simple reason, Kim Jong-un was not groomed into his position like his father was. So I would guess that he has also is less connected, and in China people know him less. So there is a genuine problem of not knowing how to interpret some of the moves that he's bringing about. But I think what was even more interesting is that while they were talking about all the serious issues, North Korea, the territorial disputes with Japan, and sort of growing sense of concerns about cyberspace, the interesting thing was that one of the senior, the vice chief of staff of the Chinese Navy, announced on Tuesday that the Chinese Navy was going for a second carrier. Now, I thought that was a very interesting point, because while they're bringing the Americans in and they're discussing about North Korea, on the back of that, they said, oh, by the way, we're going to build another carrier, and it's going to be bigger than the first one, which is very interesting in this respect.
You mentioned those the frictions, the looming frictions in the area. Let's talk about Japan now. Let's move over a little bit. This is an interesting story you've chosen here about Japan's Prime Minister Abe potentially threatening to break with the past, and this leading to more friction.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, this article is interesting because it tells us that the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Abe, wants to have a new day of celebration in Japan about the 28th of April, which is the day when the occupation ended and the San Francisco Treaty came into force. Trying to make a point that that period whereby Japan was someone else's political control is now over. This is the 21st century. We should look forward. However, it is coming out at a relatively bad timing, if you want, because it connects back to the question of the extent to which this government, this administration in Japan, has serious sort of revisionist moves on his agenda.
But it may be bad from that point of view, but I'm sure for the domestic Japanese audience, this is being viewed very positively. Abe is experiencing approval ratings near 80%. His economic policy, dubbed Abenomics, is working, I guess, from that point of view, wonderfully. So is this a new wave, then, of the Japanese kind of embracing their past a bit more, being a bit more nationalistic, something that we haven't necessarily seen in quite some time?
I think part of it, it's a question almost of egg and chicken, in the sense that one of the reasons why he's pushing for this agenda, if we look at it closely, it's because it has that kind of popular support. So I don't think it's the popular support was there because they were expecting a greater sense of nationalistic turns coming around. This question is still open there, and we'll have to wait a few months to actually get a proper answer to it.
Very briefly, to what extent do you think this ceremony on the 28th on Sunday will be a prelude to revising the constitution, which is obviously how it's being
dubbed? The revision of the constitution is absolutely on the agenda. It's something that it was in the manifesto and something that Abe has been very keen on for quite some time. So I would expect this to be part of the narrative. He's constructive to have the sort of intellectual foundation of this. Let's move on and let's start thinking about this afresh. Now, the changes in the constitution are definitely important. There are elements on it that have been around and have been discussed for quite some time. As I said, the key element here is that the risk is that by bringing this up at this particular point in time, he is going to have an important message being sort of hijacked by the circumstances of the day.
Alessio Padalano, professor of in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, setting the day's agenda with the three big stories we'll need to know. Thanks very much.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouns by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Majori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 9:19 in Marseille. It's 8:19 here in London. And it is to France where we go next. It's been nearly 1 year since François Hollande packed up his bags and moved into the Élysée Palace. He took the controls of the presidency at a time when France was limping through the worst economic crisis since the Second World War.
A poison chalice, you might say. And so far, it has indeed been a pretty rough and bumpy ride for Hollande. The economy is still flailing. Employment's on the rise and economic output is all but stagnant. Hollande's approval ratings are at record lows now. Many are already calling him a lame duck president. Some are going so far as to call him King Louis XVI for the 21st century, an unexceptional man for an exceptional time, as our guest Dominique Moïse, senior advisor at the French Institute of International Relations, told Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield a little earlier.
François Hollande is, in your view, like a modern-day Louis XVI. Why do you believe that?
Well, first, the comparison is, of course, excessive in the sense that there's no guillotine anymore and there's no violence at the end of the day. But what I had in mind was more the weakness of the leader and the feeling that he was paying for mistakes largely made by others, and that his responsibility was to be in the wrong position, in the wrong place. And that's why I use the comparison with Louis XVI. Of course, the guillotine doesn't make sense.
No, well, just as well for him. Now, you're not the only one to draw allusions between the current situation and the French Revolution. The front page of Le Point this week has asked the question, is it 1789 all over again? Why do you think there's this general feeling of a malaise in France that brings to mind what was happening at the end of the 18th century?
Well, first, because the French love to use historical comparison. I mean, in 1789, France was the center of the world, so to speak. And there's a feeling, well, if we can use symbolically the comparison with the past, it means that we still exist. So there is an element of self-fulfilling pride, even if a negative one. At the same time, I think the comparison stems from the feeling in many French circles that the present crisis is of a different nature, that it can even be considered as a regime crisis, that the divorce between French elite and French public at large has reached a very preoccupying level, and that, of course, the comparison that comes to mind is France at the end of the 18th century.
You use that phrase, regime crisis, and it's interesting that you look at it that way rather than in terms of the personalities or the figures involved, because in all this, I don't detect, you know, from this side of the channel, any great groundswell of support for Nicolas Sarkozy. No one's saying, oh my God, we made a terrible mistake, bring back Nico. There's no call for other figures on the left. No one wishes that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was there or even Ségolène Royal. I mean, it's almost as if there are no major political figures to turn to.
Yes. Well, that's exactly why I speak of a regime crisis. In a way, the state has been downgraded in terms of its perception by French citizens already under Nicolas Sarkozy. I mean, under Nicolas Sarkozy, there was a feeling that the dignity of the state was at stake, that the French president, Sarkozy, did not incarnate the French presidency well. I mean, you have to realize that in France, the French president is an elected monarch. He is at the same time the equivalent of the Queen of England, the symbol of power, and of the Prime Minister of England, the reality of power. So that was, under Sarkozy, an attack on the dignity of the function. And now under François Hollande, there is a feeling that, well, this man is not presidential enough either. He's too normal. I write somewhere in my piece, a too normal man for too exceptional circumstances. In the case of Sarkozy, there was an emphasis on the essence of the man, though one appreciated his energy, his action. In the case of Hollande, there's a feeling that, well, the man is, though very intelligent, and much better than his image, not necessarily at the level of the problems France is facing, and that there is a great disappointment vis-à-vis his performance. What have been the structural reforms he has seriously engaged in the past nearly 1 year, except, of course, when it comes to society problems and gay marriage law that was passed.
Dominic, I want to ask you what François Hollande can do to turn this around, because of course in France, you know, the president serves fixed terms. He's going to be in office for another 4 years, barring something quite exceptional. How does he turn this around to ensure that he's not a lame duck president for another 4 years?
Well, he has to be courageous. He has to do what he has refused to do in the past 10 months, which is at the same time to challenge the trade union and the leftist, the most leftist part of his support, and to challenge the markets and Brussels. What I have in mind is a French president that would be much more flexible and liberal when it comes to microeconomy that would return the flexibility of labor laws, that would give oxygen into the system, and at the same time would be much more Keynesian in macroeconomy, would engage the state in big projects that would create jobs, that would imply some kind of growth, and that would change potentially the mood of the French people.
You say there, you know, he should be more Keynesian. I mean, this is the sort of thing that he talked about, you know, when he was running for election. He said, you know, he was going to end austerity, that there would be, you know, he was talking about Keynesian economics, but that hasn't happened at all, has it?
No, it hasn't. He was not daring enough. In a way, he sat in between two chairs, between, I would say, the respect for trade union on the one hand and the respect for the market on the other. And because of that, he gave the impression of being rather immobile and clearly not doing the things that are needed at this present moment to rock the boat a little bit, but in a positive way.
And that was Dominique Moisy, senior advisor at the French Institute of International Relations, speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, a little earlier.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:26 here in London, 12:26 in Islamabad, where joining us on the line is Monocle's contributor, Samira Shackle. Good morning, Samira.
Hi.
Thank you very much for joining us. Let's start with this worrying development. 8 bomb blasts in the past 24 hours in Pakistan, rocking 3 provinces in particular. Tell us more.
Yeah, so as you said, it's actually gone up to 9 now. There are 9 blasts across 3 different provinces. So that's Balochistan in the southwest, which is a very it's a very volatile province. You might remember there was a huge bomb attack there in January targeting a minority community there. There was another in Karachi, which is again a very volatile city in the south of the country. That's the country's economic hub. And also there were several blasts in the far north of the country, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, including Peshawar, which is the main city there. So you've got about 75 people injured, at least 11 dead. It looks set to go up. And it's very worrying. I mean, people have been talking since the election campaign was launched in March. People have been very worried about the upped Taliban threat, and it sort of seems to be materialising now.
Well, you mentioned the country is in the midst of an election campaign, the election being held on the 11th of May. You mentioned the Taliban there. Do we know the purpose of these series of attacks?
Well, it's not entirely clear. They haven't stated an aim for each one, but what we do know is that the Taliban are specifically targeting the secular liberal parties. So that is most of the parties that are in the outgoing ruling coalition. So that's the Pakistan People's Party, which heads up the ruling coalition, the MQM, which is the party that dominates in Karachi, which was specifically targeted in the bomb attack there, and the ANP, which is a party popular in the northwest as well as in Karachi, and both of those parties have been targeted as well. So I think what we're seeing here is there's almost what some people have referred to as sort of pre-election vote rigging by the Taliban. So they're really affecting the ability of these secular liberal parties, the parties who are very vocally critical of them, they're affecting their ability to campaign, whereas if you look at the other side of the spectrum, the more conservative rightist parties, those who don't criticize the Taliban, they're sort of free to hold as many big rallies as they want. They're not scared of attack. And those who are slightly more in the middle, for instance, the Pakistan Muslim League, who are the current front runners, and Imran Khan's party, they're both being quite reticent about criticizing the Taliban. And I think that's probably a part of a deliberate plan to stay safe over the election.
Samira, I see that half of Karachi's polling stations have now been declared sensitive. That's of nearly 3,700. What will be the likely impact, just practically speaking, on the election, do you think?
Yeah, well, Karachi is a really difficult spot, actually. I was living there before, and it's very, very volatile. So even taking the terrorist violence out of the equation, there's a huge tension between different ethnic groups. There's a lot of sectarian violence. And so many people have been questioning for months whether you can logistically hold free and fair elections in Karachi. You have sort of warring mafias, gangs, ethnic groups, criminal elements coming into it, affiliated to political parties. And so I think certainly in a lot of areas it's going to be very difficult for people to come out and vote large in Karachi, which is, after all, the biggest city in the country. We're talking a city of somewhere between 20 and 25 million people. So I think people are going to be quite scared about voting because it is volatile. And in the last election there, in a lot of parts of the country, the worry is sort of bomb attacks and things on polling stations. In Karachi, there's a huge amount of gun violence, random attacks, and people may be worried just about getting caught in the crossfire.
And Samira, finally, it's just been over a month since Pervez Musharraf returned to Pakistan after several years in exile. He's already made plenty of headlines, and I understand it's still a very hot topic, Musharraf's arrest.
Yes, indeed. So he has sort of made that. I think the funny thing is, when he first arrived back a month ago, as you said, I think it was more of interest to the international community than it was to Pakistanis, who were slightly frustrated that it's the first ever democratic transition in the country's history, and yet the international media only want to hear about the return of an ousted military dictator. But I think it's unfolded in a very dramatic way, and as you mentioned, his arrest. And now, as the dust settles from that arrest, there's a lot of questions about how it's going to play out. And, you really cannot, it's impossible to stress enough how dramatic it would be if a former military leader was prosecuted for something he did during his time as head of the military. I mean, this is a country where you refer to the country within the country as the military, or, people say other countries have an army. In Pakistan, the army has a country. So what people are quite worried about and interested in a way is to see whether the army are going to allow one of their own. He may be retired now, but he was their head for many years. They're going to allow him to actually go through due process and be prosecuted and jailed.
Samira, we're going to have to leave it there, but fascinating stuff as ever. Monocle's Samira Shackle, live from Islamabad. In the next half hour on the programme, we'll be reviewing the Brazilian front pages with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and we'll hear how our brains map urban environments.
Looking at taxi drivers, we could see that they only really use their hippocampus at the beginning of a journey, and that fits their kind of subjective reports that they say, well, it's like the vehicle takes over. As I drive through a city, I don't really think about it. My car does all the work for me.
Someone who does all the work for us. Barney Burnham now with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Clemmie. Recognition at last. The number of people killed in the collapse of an 8-storey building in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka, has risen to at least 160. That figure is expected to rise as many more are feared trapped in the ruins. Thursday has been declared a national day of mourning. US investigators have told a House of Representatives committee that the bombs used at the Boston Marathon were detonated by the kind of remote device used to control a toy car. It's also been revealed that an FBI-led joint terrorism task force in Boston was alerted when one of the two suspected bombers travelled to Russia in 2011. Thousands of people have attended a dawn service held at Anzac Cove in Gallipoli to mark the 98th anniversary of the day Australian and New Zealand troops landed during the First World War. In a campaign lasting 8 months, the Allied forces were eventually evacuated with heavy casualties from both sides of over 120,000. The publisher of a French celebrity magazine has been placed under formal investigation for breach of privacy over last year's publication of topless pictures of Britain's Duchess of Cambridge. A judicial source says the female photographer who snapped the pictures has also been put under investigation, as has the regional daily La Provence, which published photographs of Prince William and his wife in swimming suits during the same holiday. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton Hill. This week, The Urbanist is looking at cities and science, from the ecology of Berlin's bombed-out bits to what the Santiago Metro is learning from medical research. But in this preview, we're taking a look at the brain, specifically the hippocampus. That's the bit of your brain in charge of memory, and it plays an important role in helping you get around the city. How else would you remember the way to the pub? Or for me, I don't know how I remember the way home from the pub.
More to the point. Well, there you go. Mapping cities in our brains is clearly very important. But where we beat sat-nav is even more interesting. When the hippocampus stops its work, how is it we can still get around? Dr. Hugo Spears is a lecturer at the Institute of Behavioural Sciences at University College London. He met with Urbanist producer David Michon to discuss how our brains get from A to B.
So one of the questions we want to know as neuroscientists and psychologists is, how do people learn the layout of a city? How does the mind represent the city's layout and its structure in terms of remembering what happened to you and also remembering how to get to work in the morning, how to go to your favorite cafe, all those things? How does the mind and the brain do that?
Why is that useful for us then, once we kind of understand that functioning of the brain?
Yeah, it's quite important because, it's a fundamental part of being human. So first step one is kind of curiosity. But beyond that, there's a real imperative to understand it, because as we all age as a population, many more of us are getting Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, which really cripple that capacity to imagine the city, to navigate, to where did you put your keys even in your apartment. All that starts to go wrong. So the more we can learn about how that process is done inside our brain, the better.
You've done a couple of experiments, one of which is published already and one of which is kind of currently under review. Can you maybe talk about the way you've approached kind of understanding this function?
Most researchers in neuroscience psychology have a very small little laboratory room where they'll have a computer and they'll study how people perform certain tasks, and it's nicely controlled and so on. But as soon as you want to know questions about how do people keep track of where their destination is, or remember a route they've taken, or make decisions about a path through a city, you can't really do that very well in a laboratory. So one of the approaches I've taken is to really go out into, leave the laboratory and go out into the real world, go into the city and actually get people to do tasks within it. And there's two ways my research group and others have approached this. One is to simulate in virtual reality cities, so that we can actually have people, whilst they're sitting in a brain scanner, we can peer inside their head, we can actually allow them to explore and navigate a city that's virtually recreated. And in the past, I've used a £2 million simulation from Sony that they generated that allowed, in the case of what I was looking at, London taxi drivers to navigate their way through this virtual version of London. And we're able to peer inside their brain and see that, for example, a bit of their brain, the hippocampus, is actually majorly used at the beginning of their journey. And as previous research by Eleanor McGuire at UCL had shown, this is the bit that expands. So these taxi drivers, over 16 years or so, over that time frame, they grow a larger part of the hippocampus. So it's that sort of experiment.
And what is the hippocampus? Is it controlled memory or...?
Yes, so it's a really deep structure inside the head. It's a bit of the brain that is essential for memory. If you were to suddenly lose that, something happened to you where you lost the hippocampus, you would, if we got up from this interview, went away and I asked you what were you just doing, you would not remember this interview. You would ask me who I was and you would forget completely. It's essential for that type of memory.
What was the result of that experiment?
So that experiment had lots of different results, and one of them was looking at taxi drivers. We could see that they only really use their hippocampus at the beginning of a journey. So they'd expand this bit of the brain, and we know it's crucial. They only really use it right at the beginning. They don't keep relying on their memory as a journey takes place. And that fits their kind of subjective reports, that they say, well, it's like the vehicle takes over. As I drive through a city, I don't really think about it. My car does all the work for me. To contextualize as well, these London taxi drivers are very unusual in the world. You don't find the same kind of knowledge anywhere else. They have to spend 2 to 4 years training to gain what in London's known as the knowledge of London, the 250,000 streets. And they have to pass a horrendous exam, which is they typically fail time and time again, where they can be tested on any 2 points in the city and they have to tell you exactly which streets they'd use to get there. And any mistake gets them sent down and come back for retesting.
And so if at some point you stop using your memory while navigating, then what are you relying on?
Well, it depends. There's lots of circumstances where you rely on different types of memory. So I doubt you're very conscious in the morning about what decisions you're making to get to your office or going to the park you know very well. It just seems to be done on what we might call colloquially as autopilot. But there are other bits of the brain that are remembering those sorts of journeys that actually are taking care of that. So there's different circuits in your brain that you actually use to navigate the city with, depending on how familiar the route is. But if you think about a sat-nav or a GPS device, that really is taking out all of that decision-making. It's not, you don't have to rely on your memory. You're really using a lot of strategies and manipulating what you know with what's coming out of the device. And there's a lot of interest at the moment in research in how that's happening.
Do we have kind of a superior sat-nav then? Is it something that's beyond just kind of mapping out a city and being told to turn left and turn right? What is there some kind of added value to the way the brain works?
Well, I guess that would be a great thing to be able to advance these sat-nav devices to make them even more impressive, because they are clearly better. They have so much more information than any human would have, right? Because they've got maps of the Earth to work with. So they outcompete any human in terms of knowledge. But, you know, they don't have the nuances to know exactly what the most scenic route at the moment is that you might gain as a human. And they can't really, I mean, we can tag all these different places with significance. You know, is this a nice place or a bad place that also isn't in the sat-nav? So there's sort of advantages to being human. And certainly there have been instances where people have died because they're relying on, many now, and sad instances of people relying on the sat-nav, not in a city but out in the wilderness, and it going wrong and them not knowing how to find their way home.
Riveting stuff. That was Dr. Hugo Spears speaking to the urbanists David Michon for this week's Science Special. And you can catch the show, including the full interview with Dr. Spears, at 1900 hours London time tonight.
And you are, of course, listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at the design directory in this month's edition of Monocle.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one, just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chiltern Street and Marylebone, pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Feeling that love for Robert Bound,
I feel
you?
The love.
Just feeling it. We're also feeling the love for the new edition of Monocle. I'm holding it in my hands. It hit all good newsstands and bookstores around the world this week. And so all week to celebrate, we've been selecting stories from the issue. And today we're shifting our gaze to the dazzling design pages of the magazine.
They are indeed spectacular. And joining us in the studio to discuss the theme, as we said, the design directory is Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, and photo director, Poppy Shibamoto. Welcome to the studio to both of you. Thanks very much for coming in. I've just got to say right off the bat, I'm extremely somewhat depressed because this is my dream house, this design directory, and I just can't.
Mine too. I have to do this almost every month. And I know it's a continual plight of mine that I go into the homes of beautiful homes of often beautiful people as well.
I'm dying. The loft apartment conversion in Brooklyn Heights. I'm looking at it and all those books. And I mean, why can't I live there, Hugo?
Oh, don't.
Make it happen.
One day, Clemency, one day. Well, the design directory, let me tell you a bit about it to start with. It's 48 pages. For the first time this year, we're going to do two. This one is the spring-summer one in the May issue. And we're going to follow that up in November with autumn-winter, which is going to be far more focused on architecture and construction. So for this one, we kept it simple and went indoors. It's very, very domestic. It's supposed to be a practical guide for people about how to build a home, the things to fill it with, not just things, but also how to live in it. So in here we have 25 people objects, furniture that we have scoured the globe to bring you the stories behind them. Obviously, they're lovely things, but the business practice that goes into making them is very good as well. That's obviously something that we promote a lot in Monocle. We have five studios that you can call on who can come in and do everything from architectural renovation in your home to furnishing. They can actually make the furniture for you as well. They're sort of really one-stop shops. We also have three shops that are in fact one-stop shops to go and get everything for your home. And we have a series of illustrations as well that are our dream house inventory. And Poppy, maybe you can talk a little bit about how we go about doing these illustrations, which people might look at that and think, well, why haven't they just put everything in a studio and arranged it so that we can see it?
Yeah, I think this is the first time we are doing more practical design directory. So we wanted to make it look also for readers to think like, this is just an example. And then they could put things together in a different way, but this is just one way of doing it. You know, we do every year something that is sort of perfect home. So this is just one scenario. And I think it's, it gives a bit more imaginative way to show it. And, you know, this is not just one way, and maybe the readers can think of another
exactly.
way of doing
it. It's supposed to be a suggestion
here.
Of a way yes. of living rather than a blueprint for
exactly.
what
so,
to do.
Poppy, maybe you could just give us some insights. You know, there are these fascinating pieces, you know, ranging from a mug to shelves. How do you go about photographing these kinds of things and really bringing them to life? Because they do really seem to all tell their own story in just this one picture, even though it is really just, you know, a mug on a table, but it still seems to say so much.
It's 99% Hugo gets me a nice product and that's my job done. And then after that, it's just basically trying to shoot it in simplest way. We don't go too much with decorating sets or anything, so it's just very simple so you can see the product well in a natural, nice soft light, but usually just the pick of the product.
Hugo, you talked about doing this every year and this being a kind of evolving thing. Do you feel that there are trends that are evolving in the design world that you're really picking up on here? And what's sort of big for this year?
Quite refreshing, actually, to have really stripped it back and done something about the home, because we talk about trends not in a trend forecasting way as such, but the design industry is going through enormous problems, and traditional relationships between manufacturers, designers, retailers and consumers has sort of been turned on its head, with furniture industries around the world all having enormous problems with funding. And that sort of unease, I think, is beginning to creep into the way people live. Furniture is becoming a status symbol in a way that it really shouldn't be. So to go back to basics and say, actually, this is a chair, it's from IKEA, it works beautifully, it will probably still work and you can sit in it and enjoy sitting in it 50 years from now, just because it costs €49 rather than 4,900, has nothing to do with the quality of the material or the enjoyment of using it. So from the point of view of people might look at this and think, well, why haven't they taken a more business analytical approach to design, which is something that we do every issue in Monocle.
Yeah.
We wanted to remind people that actually a home is a sanctity. Mm. The way you live in it provides quality of life, you know, more than anything, pretty much.
And it's, you know, that perfect marriage in its best possible manifestation of form and function. And
exactly.
as you say, something that
and those things can all too often
and
be overlooked when, you look at sort of plummeting furniture exports in Italy and things.
Yeah.
And there are so many things you, Hugo, found locally as well. Like, you know, like it's not about sourcing from always from Milan, but something from close by.
And in fact,
the carpenters to make your
having just come back from Salone del Mobile, the giant annual Milan furniture fair, it was quite nice to almost completely ignore that and to go and look at tiny little villages, maybe in rural Australia, or there's a beautiful little craft workshop that we photographed that is an hour and a half north of Helsinki. And these are the stories that too often get overlooked in place of the giant furniture manufacturers that everyone is looking to see what the future of the industry is going to be like.
Sorry, Phil, go ahead. And we're so excited about this. We've got so much
so
to ask
questions.
You.
I think one of the my favorite parts of the design directory is the part on interiors, five studios, where you head to New York, places like New York, Tokyo, London. You can really get a sense, can't you, of the style of each country in these interiors. Tell me a bit about kind of what makes a typical London home your typical London home versus a typical home in Sydney, for example.
Well, firstly, I'm very glad that you picked up on that because it was no small task trying to find a residence in each city and a studio that had designed it that reflected what the character of that city was about. In Brooklyn, we went to somebody who'd done a really beautiful loft conversion. And it's not all exposed brick and beams and things like you might think. There's a lot of sort of domestic charm in there as well.
And so many books. I can't tell you how happy.
I know, I knew that was why you liked it.
I'm so happy to see a studio that's stuffed with books.
But what we really wanted was design studios that didn't just go in and put their stamp on somewhere. Each one of these studios is characterised by the fact that they go and they spend time with the people that they're working with to really bring out what they want, probably before they even know they want it themselves. And that's what interior design, which has such a bad name nowadays, when you look at the thousands of interior design titles with exactly the same whitewashed apartments on the front of them. We want people to have the confidence to live in a way that they want to live unselfconsciously. There's no right or wrong when it comes to living or decorating a home.
Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I think we could literally talk about this for hours on end.
I just want to know, before we say goodbye to you, though, your highlight. What, like, if there's one thing in the directory that you're most proud of or most salivating over or most excited about, what is it?
Well, right at the end, we take three residences. We've got one in Rio, we've got one in Chiba in Japan, and a third one. Where's the third one, Poppy? Copenhagen. They are really, really beautiful. They're full-bleed photos that go into immense detail. I think that's very inspiring.
Well, Monocle's design editor Hugo McDonald and our photo director Poppy Shibamoto, thank you very much for joining us this morning. And what a tremendous amount of work has gone into that design directory. It is in the new edition of Monocle, which is on all good newsstands and in bookstores right now. ...8:51 here in London. Before we go through the Brazilian front pages in a moment, let's listen to Seja Feliz, Be Happy by Marisa Monte, who's currently on a European tour. Tonight she'll be playing Porto, then heading to Lisbon, Barcelona and Madrid.
And that was Seja Feliz, which means be happy in Portuguese. You may recognize this song. She performed at the closing ceremonies of the London Olympics last summer. Of course, Rio will host the Olympics in 2016. And staying in Brazil, we have our resident Brazilian here in the studio with us, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks very much for coming in.
Hello, Phil. Hello, Clemency. How are you?
Very well. Massively cheered by the sight of your legs out in all of their glory.
A Brazilian always show their legs if it's sunny outside. Today's a beautiful day, you know. So.
And you've got a couple of the front pages from Brazil. And one of the stories that we actually spoke about last week when you came on here on Midori House was the Brazilian parliament suspending the creation of political parties. But apparently now that's been overturned by the Supreme Court.
Exactly. I was so happy about that. Remember that, Phil? I even wrote like saying, well done, Brazil, finally, because, you know, we have 24 parties in our Congress, and that's a lot. But then a lot of politicians criticized that. And actually, our Supreme Court decided yesterday that this motion was anti-democratic somehow. So, so basically we're not going to have that anymore. So, which is a shame, because I think Brazil really should think about that. Maybe they should do that after the presidential elections next year. And then the debate will not be heated and people will not say, oh, that's unfair because there's an election coming up, you know. So I hope this will happen. So,
to what extent is it driven, do you think, by those sorts of, well, by the political time frame?
Well, I mean, I'm not that cynical, but it is a bit weird because, for example, Marina Silva, the leader of the Green Party, she's the previous leader of the Green Party, she's about to launch a new party. And then this new project came at the same time. And Marina Silva, I would say, on the recent polls, Dilma Rousseff, our current president, she's number one, and Marina Silva is number two on the polls. So probably this would affect Marina Silva somehow. So yeah, maybe there was a bit. So I would say maybe let's wait for next year until the presidential elections are over, and then I think we should do that.
But I think for some of us who obviously don't know Brazil's political system as intimately as you do, would say in a democracy, why can't you be able to create a political system if you want to? Shouldn't they be allowed?
They should be allowed, but the project wouldn't forbid completely. They would just make it a bit harder, you know, in terms of funding, in terms of how many members of the public should sign, because I believe it's fairly easy. Basically, if you have the money, you can create a political party.
If I wanted to have the Philhan Brazil party,
can do it, you know.
Oh, I see what's happening here.
If I want to create the sunny, lovely party by Fernando, you know, I could
wear shorts
could do it.
Every day campaign.
Exactly. As long as I have a couple of millions in my pocket, it's all fine.
Let's stick with
That's actually a good idea.
Let's stick with the same paper, but move on to a story about flanelinhas.
Exactly. I mean, this is, I believe, is a foreign concept that only Brazilians would understand. Because, you know, São Paulo, it can be a little bit dangerous sometimes. We know when you park on the street, there's always a man outside saying that he would take care of your car somehow. That's illegal. I mean, he shouldn't be there, basically. And people, they always pay money for this flanelinha somehow. And if you don't pay, be careful, because they can kind of destroy your car or do something with your car. So people are always cared about that. But now it's on the news again, because some offices in São Paulo, they're actually paying a monthly fee for those guys, for the flanelinhas. So it kind of becomes
So wait, do they then take the money that the flanelinhas get? Or what are the economics of it?
So basically, these companies, they are paying the flanelinhas for their workers to
look after.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're kind of institutionalizing it.
Exactly.
Semi-legalizing it.
And it's so boring, because I remember when I was in São Paulo, if I go to a bakery, let's say, you know, just for 5-10 minutes to buy bread, you know, whatever, I have to pay at least, you know, I don't know, let's say £5 or something to the flanelinha.
£5? Goodness me.
They are. I mean, I remember if I gave like 1 real, which was about 50p here, and they say, oh, only that, you know, and then I was like, okay, I'll give you more, you know. So yeah, it is a bit.
Inflation. It's doing some crazy things.
Yeah.
The tomatoes. Oh, we always talk about the tomato crisis.
Brazil's becoming too expensive. Flanelinhas, tomatoes, you know, what's next?
Renato, another story in O Globo, in regards to if you're a student or if you're over 60, you just pay half price in some things.
Exactly. And that's another thing that I think is extremely unfair. Basically, if you're a student under 18 or over 60, you pay half price in music show, in concerts, in cinema, everything. You might think this is good, but actually not really. Because now if you go to most businessmen, they say 70% of their tickets are sold as half price, which makes prices itself more expensive. And now they want to limit that. They said that only 40% of all tickets can be sold as half price, which I think is fair and will make tickets a little bit cheaper, because now they put the price so high that even the half price is still expensive.
Fernando, you are priceless as ever, but we are going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. Thanks so much for joining us, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's all we have time for. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando, and James Bullock, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is The Culture Show with Robert Bound. This week, the team look into the world of nonsense poetry and much more. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, but meanwhile, from me, Clemency Burton Hill.
And me, Phil Hahn.
Thanks for listening.
Bye bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.